Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Go really electric with an EV or plug-in hybrid from the Kia e-range.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. And Joe at RTE.ie. This discussion about attacks by gangs of young people began 2 weeks ago on Liveline when two women talked about being randomly and unprovoked attacks by groups of young men, some young women involved from age 10 upwards, sometimes on bikes, who seem to be rambling around various parts. Stories so far of Dublin. Now, we heard on the news from Paul Reynolds that the Garda serious crime figures are down, but and this form of crime has definitely gone up during the pandemic, looking at our phone log. And we've another one, we've another two today, actually, beginning with a most horrific video that was sent to us by Sojay Matthews. He runs a shop, a gala shop, on Willow Park Crescent in Glasnevin / Ballymun. Willow Park Crescent, for those of you who don't know that part of the city, is about 50 yards from Cedarwood Road. It actually goes around onto Cedarwood Road, and Cedarwood Road is, because of U2, is on the album, is number 10, is where Bono was born. So it's a few hundred yards from that house. And Sojay Matthews, I know the locals who you speak very highly of call you Matthew. So Matthew, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joy. Good afternoon.
Tell us what happened last Thursday. We've seen the videos. We're going to try and get them out past the lunatic GDPR, because these guys are committing horrific crime. What happened, Matthew?
Thursday evening, around 6:30, the group of youngs, they're gathering together around this area, and a few of them, not in front of the shop, they are near the shop. There is a small park. They're gathering together and come into the shop, around 15-20 kids all together, and come into the shop and take the things, the ice creams, jellies, chocolates, and all those things. They grab the things and they start to throwing this to the staff, even though one of them in the till, and they're throwing to the things to the staff. And then immediately one of the staff came and he pulled down the shutter.
Yeah, and we see that. In between that time,
they went outside and throwing again and into the shop. And there is ice creams, and I don't know, there is maybe a few stones or something. One of my staff was little hurt or injured his finger.
Okay, we'll try and, as I say, we'll try and pixelate the video, but because they're obviously committing a crime, they swarm into the shop, about 15 or 20 of them in their tracksuits. We count at one stage 13 teenagers running into the shops. They basically rampage around the shop, grabbing whatever they want and not bothered. One of them was actually videoing himself, I presume, for Snapchat.
There is many of them outside the videos. There is a few cameras outside the shops.
Crazy. That's
the more videos I have, the more videos.
Yeah, and then you have video of them gathering outside, and they just run in and like rats, overtake the shop, grab whatever they want, and start throwing some of the product at you and your staff, and then they nonchalantly, 13 of them leave the shop. They obviously feel they're totally immune from the Gardaí. And then they start attack when you and your colleagues run out to try and, I presume, retrieve some of your stolen product. They start lobbing some of the products they've stolen back at you and trying to attack you, and you have to pull down the shutters. And do we know where these group of young people are from, Matthew? Are they locals? Do you know them?
They are not from the locals. They are, most of them, I think, new faces, because we can't recognize the face, because there are a few of them wearing the mask and all those things. And around that time, in this area, around more than 100 kids surrounding.
Wow.
More than 100 kids they're surrounding this area.
And what did they, we can't hear obviously on the video, what do they say? What were they shouting when you were in the shop?
They are not shouting that much, but they are showing, they're throwing something, you know, they're attacking. They did not, because I was not here, actually, staff was there. They did not tell anything for that one. They are shouting, actually. They are shouting means, we can't tell like that way, you know. So, like that way, you know, they are...
Well, do you think there was a racist motivation?
Because this one, maybe I can't say like that, but most of the, because I'm here around 2.5 years, the shop was around 4-6 years now, but I will not feel anything from the neighbors or my locals. They are very supporting for me, even though happened this one. Many of them calling and personally they came into the shop and, you know, their attitude. Their
and did you so, did you open it after you pulled down the shutters to try and
protect? No. That Friday, Thursday I didn't open. Then Friday only open because I was here always now after that. Yeah. Even the next day also, the same like that, they started to gathering together. But some locals and my neighbors called the guards. So immediately guards came and after that they ran away from this area.
Okay, well, as I say, the video has to be seen to be believed. They're just so immune. And there's a lot of these videos knocking around the last few weeks. That fight on Samuel Beckett Bridge, that 16, 17-year-old... boasting, it's not in your case, another part of the city, boasting about this knife that he had. Knife isn't a word, it's like a machete hidden under his jacket. Stay there, Matthew, because we've been contacted by Mina Choi. Mina, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. Hi,
how are
thanks
you?
For
You're
having
on WhatsApp,
me on the show.
Which is a really clear line. Tell us, you were attacked by a gang of teenagers as well. When did it happen, Mina?
It happened last Tuesday, March 23rd, about 9:50 p.m. I was walking back from, I think it's Talbot Street, the extension of Henry Street beyond O'Connell.
Yeah,
And just after I passed the spire, I saw 10 or 12 lads. I would have guessed they were between 15 to 17 years of age. Mm-hmm. They were spread out across Henry, so you couldn't actually pass without... going through some of them.
Yeah.
And they said something and I might have talked back to them and they circled me, hit me several times on the back. They grabbed the rubbish bag, smashed it on my head in the back.
Nice.
They threw another rubbish bag. I think I managed to knock it down. Luckily, I had a walking stick, so I sort of swung it around so that they couldn't come towards me at the beginning. I mean, in front of me, and then they just, they circled me, hit me in the back. Some of them took videos with their mobile phone. One had a little dog and tried to get the dog to bite me. One of them was on a scooter. I don't know why they ran off. I mean, it was really, really scared. Had they stayed another 10 minutes, maybe I would have been on the ground bleeding. But they ran off. And then they took a left and went north on O'Connell Street. And then I was shaken and I walked away. And then I realized I better call the guards.
Okay.
And I did.
And they actually physically hit you?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, my back was stinging from where they hit me. My arm was stinging. My head. And I found out later they must have kicked me because my right ankle was swollen.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you're in the melee and you're trying to defend yourself against 10, 12 boys circling you and tossing things at you, heckling you, saying terrible things like, I don't know if I can say it on air, but you can bleep me, you know, calling you a fucking chink, hissing and saying Chinese several times, hissing at you. You're doing your best to defend yourself. I'm a woman on my own. What can I do against 10, 12 boys circling me right on Henry Street, just by the spire?
Yes, I think it's North Earl Street, where if it's a continuation of Henry Street towards Talbot Street, it's probably North.
It is Henry's because I crossed O'Connell. So it's between O'Connell and Jervis, so that is Henry Street.
Okay, sorry, you're right. Sorry, I was going the other direction. A pretty busy street, even in the lockdown. I drove past it there the way home one evening. Well, I looked up, it was a busy street. Did anyone come to your assistance, Mina?
No, that was actually really disappointing. There must have been at least 10, 12 people who must have seen it, because I can't believe. And that's the reason I use that street, because it's very well lit.
Yeah,
it's very
point.
Wide.
Yeah.
And I usually walk in the middle that way, you know. So I'm sure there were people and nobody came to my aid. Oh, so gosh. I had to grab, I grabbed the woman and asked her to help, but she moved on.
Okay.
I grabbed, there was a sanitation truck with three men, and I said, can you stay with me until I call the guards? Mm-hmm. Because I'm afraid the bloods will come back. They said, I'm working and I don't speak English. So they moved on. And then I grabbed another couple. They were pushing their bicycles. And so I said, can you please stay with me? I need to call the guards. And I'm just afraid they'll come back and attack me again. And they did. And the guards came about 20 minutes later.
Yeah. What age were they, do you think?
I can only guess. But I would say anywhere from 14 to 17, just from the look. Yeah.
And when the guard, I don't name any guardie, but when the guardie came, what did they say?
I personally felt that she was quite unhelpful. She told me how if they're under 18, it's going to be impossible to bring them to justice. She talked about the J-Lo system. I didn't understand what that was.
Juvenile liaison system, yeah.
And that there's no point. She kept asking me. So I felt like she was really asking me, do I even want to file? And I said, you know, there were 10, 12 lads, they hit me, they attacked me. If I didn't have a walking stick and I was able to swing it around just to get them not, you know, maybe it would have been worse. I'm traumatized. And I said, look, you can see the garbage bags, you know, they were bright green ones in the middle of the, on Henry Street, just before the spire. I said, you can see what they tossed at me. There was no effort to take a photo of the evidence. There was no effort. And then she asked me to come back the next night at 7 p.m. to the station, so which scared me even more. So I had to get two friends to escort me, because I thought, oh, great, now, you know, at 7 p.m., I'm now really scared. So, and the same thing happened at the station. She said, are you sure you were hit? And I said, yes, I was hit. Like, why would I make this up? Mm-hmm. And she said, I think they're very difficult to identify. I said, you know what? This is not the first time I run into them. I think if you station somebody on Henry Street on a night that's not, you know, when it's not raining, you will definitely see them coming down. It's almost the same route they took the previous time I ran into them, which is they go down Henry Street towards O'Connell. When they hit O'Connell, they make a left up towards the GPO, I guess. So the whole thing has just upset me very much.
Yeah. And then the racist abuse that's been leveled at you. Were many of them on bicycles?
One, on Tuesday night, one was on a scooter.
Okay.
And the others were walking, and one had a dog on a lead.
And he tried to set the dog on you.
Yes. Can you imagine that?
Disgusting. Yeah. And then is the language they used and the race. It was the racist abuse they used. Did you?
Oh, yeah.
I presume you said to the Gardaí, hang on, what about filing it under a hate crime, a racist attack?
I did. And then they said, why would you think that it was a racist attack? And I said, because they called me a fucking chink and they hissed Chinese several times. That's why. And I had to repeat that again when I was at the station. And I had to repeat it several times at the station, so because it kept not making its way to the report.
you wanted that included in the report.
Oh, I think it's so important.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And this is not the first time, though.
I'm so sorry,
Mina. It happens every day. It's Mina, but it happens every day in Dublin.
I'm so sorry, Mina, that you've been put through this. I really am. I really am. It's a horrific racist attack and physical attack as well by a group of young people who think they're outside the law, just like the attack on Matthew's shop in Willow Park Crescent. Louise Hassan. Louise, good afternoon.
Hello.
Okay, what happened? What? What happened to you, Louise, and your friend?
Did you see the pictures that I sent you?
No, I didn't.
Okay, so it was a group of like 10 to 12 year olds underneath a bridge, you know, at Campbell's Garage between Cabra and Finglas?
Yeah, in Dublin.
So
yeah.
there was like four of them. But the scary thing was they were all dressed in black, so they had black trousers, black hoodies, black jackets,
okay,
black shoes, and they were throwing stones at us to try to get us to fall off our bikes.
Oh, God.
And then they were trying to pull up this black railing along the canal. So we asked them to stop. And he could hear that, one of them could hear that I was English. So he was going F off Brits and up the rah and all of that. But they were just throwing stones and a Spanish guy stopped to help us. And he said, oh, where are their parents? And I was like, I don't know what to say to you.
Yeah.
But I sort of went up to them and started taking their photos and said I was going to call the guards. And then they sort of ran off. But then they came back and started throwing stones again. So it was, and the Spanish guy said that they'd thrown stones at him as well. And they were sort of jumping out in front of the cyclists and sort of screaming at them to make them try and fall off their bikes.
And the photographs, I see them here now, Louise. They're dressed in black. They're dressed, it looks like they're coordinated in their dress. They're all in hoodies, black tracksuit bottoms and runners.
Like a little gang. But I was thinking, but when you actually go up close to them, they were like 10 years old or I'd say oldest 12. So I was thinking, oh my God, like what are they going to be like when they're 18 in this sort of coordinated black hoodies, black trousers, black runners, do you know?
I know.
And like without a fear of an adult, of assaulting an adult, throwing stones at them, or, do you know, like they weren't afraid at all.
And
they were so intimidating. Like, and I would be scared of them, and they were only 10. Do you know, like 10 years old.
And I think apart from the racist element of it, that's which is horrific. Another common denominator in the three attacks we're now talking about, Willow Park Grove, Henry Street and Campbell's Garage there in Cabra, is they've no fear. They've no fear whatsoever.
No. And the really scary thing is now, you know, when you, like that 14-year-old, that awful thing on the bridge in Dublin where he stabbed the lady and she died.
Yeah, okay.
You know, but then you,
yeah, we won't, we don't know what happened in that case, so we won't mention that case.
You know, you're scared of confronting
them. Yeah, when did it happen, your attack, Louise?
Like 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But in between Cabra and Finglas now, that all the kids are riding around, you know, those little, they look like little foldable electric bikes.
Loads of them around, and they can move. They can move at a pace, can't they? They can move fast.
But what's that about? I was wondering what that was about. I keep asking people, why are they on these little foldable? Like there's gangs of them, maybe 12, 15 of them, and they're sort of coming out now into the Cabra Finglas area. And then I was going through Cabra the other day, and there was two guys zooming along on motorbikes with no helmets.
That's a phenomenon in Dublin, parts of Dublin at the minute. Okay, Louise, thanks, Niamh. Louise Hassan. Matthew, to go back to Willow Park Crescent. Matthew, have you ever received any threats from these people?
Many times.
Okay.
I can say this is the gangs coming all together. This is the first time. Because we can say there is a regular customer. We are saying the regular customers, same like regulars was there for the robbing things. They are regularly coming to the shop and taking the things from the shop, and just they will run out from the shop.
And they've no fear. It seems they've no fear.
No fear. They never fear about that thing.
Okay. And do you live above the shop, Matthew?
Sorry?
Do you live in the shop or near the shop?
No. I'm not in the leaving the shop here.
Oh, you know, okay. And like your staff, are they worried?
Of course, they're worried. Of course.
Yeah.
Because this is not like this attack is the first time. Before there was I think 1 year back there was a robbery. They're taking the things, drinks, and he just went out. And not only one time, many times he did like that way. Then I told him to don't come to the shop again, be bad. Then he threatened me. He told me straight away, I will kill you. straight away.
Oh, my God.
He said, straight away, he told me. Still, I have that videos and everything. I give the statement to the guards. That is around more than 1 year now. But still, I didn't get any reply.
He told you.
That one.
He told you he would come back and kill you.
I don't know. He's after that also many times I saw him. But yeah. He didn't. Nothing he'd do that one for me. Yeah. But still, you know, because...
Let me... Mine...
Mina, yes.
Mina, my fault all the time. Mina, is there any... Please, Mina, do not give up on this.
And thank you.
And
I
should,
no, I won't.
By the way, it should not fall on your shoulders, the victim of a savage, racist and physical attack. It should not fall on your shoulders to try and pursue this. That's the job of our Gardaí. And they should be pursuing it. Now, Mina, is there CCTV? There must be around that part of the city.
That was what was so bizarre, because when I went to make a formal complaint the next night at 7, she said that there were three TVs. I think she numbered them 214, 215, 217, and they said that they were all pointing away from the scene. And I couldn't believe that. I mean, this is Henry Street. I was walking maybe 40 yards, not even 10 yards from the spire. I couldn't believe that there was not a single camera that was pointing. And she said that one of the cameras was pointing towards the GPO. And if that's the case, it would have captured these lads.
Okay, Mina, bear with me when I read out this statement from the Gardaí. Gardaí and Store Street are investigating the assault of a woman aged in her early 50s following an incident on Henry Street, Dublin, on the night of Tuesday, the 23rd of March. That, we presume that's you, Mina.
Yes,
we presume.
I think so.
It is understood that the woman was set upon by a group of unidentified individuals. The woman did not sustain any injuries over the course of this incident.
I didn't understand that last sentence. I don't know what their definition of injury. I mean, do they mean that I need a broken arm and a slashed face?
You need blood?
I mean, I told them what happened. I told them the next night when I made the report, my back is still stinging from the hit I had, that my ankle's swollen. So I didn't know what their definition of injury is, that my head was smacked by the rubbish. I mean, they saw the rubbish on the ground. I mean, you know, why would two rubbish bags suddenly be in the middle of Henry Street just by the spire? But, you know, I don't know why they would say I was not injured. I mean,
if they're saying you did not sustain any injuries, does that mean they're saying it wasn't an assault?
No, she told me it wasn't an assault. I don't understand the legal lingo. I don't know what this means. She assured me it was going to be registered as an assault.
Okay.
And when I did report it, she kept backtracking and she said, "You sure they hit you?" I mean, she asked me that. And I said, why would I lie about that?
A group of 12 couriers in Dublin city centre were not coming up with setting their dog on you, surrounding you in a circle. They were not coming up to wrap you in cotton wool, were they? They weren't.
Oh,
they were coming up
to
attack you. And the language and the racist language they used
was
horrific.
They hit me. I mean, they hit me from the back.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, they hit me. Sorry. So, yeah. So I don't know. I had to call a friend and said, why would they say that? Is the definition of injury different in Ireland? You know, as you can tell from my accent, I'm not from here. So I said, is something technical that I don't understand?
Yeah.
That's all I said.
Do not give, as I say, Mina, it should not be up to you to pursue. This has to be pursued. And all of these attacks, these groups of young people.
Joe, I just want to say that I have now spent tens of hours making this complaint come to light, because it's been sort of, I could see that it was kind of going to be swept under the, you know, under the rug. And I've asked, because I speak Korean and I speak Chinese. So I've now asked a lot of people around Capel Street and that area, you know, a lot of the Chinese takeaways and a lot of the restaurants. And I said, have you faced attack? And one Korean gentleman who didn't want to be named told me that he faces harassment attack nearly on a daily basis. And he said more than a year ago, he nearly died. they attacked him. He nearly died. And he said it's all these young kids. And he said they always operate in a group. They're cowards. Yeah, they will never do it on if they're one or two. But if they're in a gang, it's very dangerous. I mean, he wasn't lying when he said he nearly died. I called him today and I said, would you be willing to go on Joe Duffy's show and talk about it? And he said, no. And that is the problem with a lot of
fear.
The Asians.
I know.
Not just fear, they have a bad relationship with law enforcement, so they don't trust from the countries they come from. Secondly, they're a little bit, they can't speak English that well, so they feel that they can't express themselves and they don't want to. They are afraid of kind of backlash, that maybe some of the guardies hear them on radio or whatever, that they'll come and harass them at their shops. So just, there must be hundreds of incidents that are going unreported.
Yeah, and that's why, Mina, that's why I think Matthew, who's on the other line, he is allowing us name his shop and the location where he was attacked, which is very, very brave of him as well. Remember, one of them has threatened to kill him. By the way, Matthew, the Gardaí statement on your attack.
Yep.
On Garda Síochána does not comment on named entities. What does that mean in English? However, Gardaí are investigating a public order incident. I'm determined to get that video out. However, Gardaí are investigating a public order incident that occurred at a retail premises on Willow Park Road. It's actually Willow Park Crescent, Finglas, shortly before 6 p.m. on Saturday, the 25th of March. It was on Thursday, wasn't it?
Thursday.
Yeah, it wasn't Saturday. No arrests have been made. Investigations are ongoing. We're battling hard to get that video out, Matthew, because it's disgusting. And we have to find CCTV. Not that we need it, Mina, because your evidence is overwhelming. But we needed to try and identify. But even looking at Louise Hassan's photographs, I hope we can put them out as well. They're all dressed in such a way, the same outfits, all black hoodies, that they can't be. You'd find it very hard to pick one of them out. John, good afternoon. What happened? You say three times you've been attacked.
Three times. The first time it was like just bottles of water being thrown at my body, you know, like small bottles, but full of water. And one hit the back of my shoulders, which was bad enough. I did report that now to the Gardaí, and the Gardaí came out and said, oh, yeah, this is quite a common thing in this small town there. They stand at the bus stop and they just wait if you're a bit vulnerable, and they wait till you go by and then they start to throw it. The second time, I was on my bicycle, the second time, again, coming out of the local supermarket, and they had just, as I was putting the groceries on, they kind of came up and, you know, that kind of thing of shocking you, rattling the handle back. And again, but when it happens to you, you know, there's three or four gather around you, it's like very shocking. But the last time was last week, and I wasn't going to do anything about it until I heard that woman of the Chinese story, on Henry Street, and that really provoked me to call you, Joe. But what it was, about half five, completely broad daylight, I'd come out and I had two heavy bags on this old bicycle. It's a good old bicycle around the town. Put the two bags on, and I had left the supermarket to join the main road, as I usually do, nice and slow coming down. I saw them bouncing a ball, and I just thought, oh, here we go now. That ball, I say, that's going to be for me, you know? They kicked the ball at the bike, so that was a weapon. Obviously, I had to stop then, and the bike would tint, and that's when the three or four of them kind of came up, and within an instant, Joe, they just took one of the bags, I think it was on the one on the left-hand side, full of groceries, and just threw it into the opposite ditch.
Just brazen again. Now, brazen.
Get on with you. Now, at that point, I didn't even look. I wasn't going to, because I know the crowd. You know what I mean? They seem to have disappeared for a good while, but now it just seems that the game is back on.
And what age group again, John?
This is all, say, from about 12 to 18, if you want to call it that, you know?
Yeah.
Some on bikes, some not on bikes, you know?
Okay. And
but I just carried on then and went home. But again, I should phone in after hearing the Chinese one. I just thought, no, I mean, you know,
Now, the Gardaí, what I understand is the Gardaí is saying, the CSO are saying that serious crime is down one third during the pandemic, which is brilliant and is primarily due to the work of the Gardaí against the gangs. Incredible work. But that level of crime that we're talking about has a serious effect on people, and especially when there's a gang of them, as in Matthew's case, as in Mina's case, and as in your case, John, and as in the cases over the last 10 days we've heard on Liveline. Okay, John, thanks indeed. By the way, for newspapers who hopefully will pick up this story so it won't be forgotten, Mina Choi is spelled M-I-N-A-C-H-O-Y. And thank you, Mina, for your bravery. I'm so sorry that you were abused like that, 100 yards from where our country was effectively formed in 1916. Matthew, I admire your bravery, and please keep going. You provide a great service in that area. You're open from early morning to late at night, so well done to you and your staff, Matthew, and to your family. Well done for your bravery. Okay, joe@rte.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And joe@rte.ie. The figures today are what, nearly 780,000 vaccinations so far. But as we heard here on Friday, the reaction to the private hospital looking after the private school, the Beacon looking after Gerard, and even though, as we heard, there was people in the hospital who should have been vaccinated. But anyway, and we presume, well, hopefully the 20 teachers that were picked or whatever from St. Gerard's are all healthy people. Obviously they must be if they're in work. Now, again, just here's another sample of people who still haven't got the vaccine, despite the fact that I heard with my own two ears this morning that everyone over 80 in the country had been vaccinated. Adrian O'Brien, what age is your father?
Hi, Joe. My dad is 92 years of age.
He's okay, 93. Mary McGing, what age is your mother?
And my mother's 90.
Adrian O'Brien, has your father been vaccinated?
He has not, no.
Okay, Mary McGing, has your mother been vaccinated?
No.
Why has your father not been vaccinated, Adrian?
I don't know, Joe. It seems like the people that are housebound have been forgotten. He's housebound. I've registered him for the vaccine in the protocol that was set out, but we've heard nothing. There's no communication on it.
Well, the ambulance service, the National Ambulance Service, apparently are doing it. And over the last, and I know they're a great service, so that's, but they're obviously doing it with resources. We were told they were doing a brilliant job. Have you had any contact about when, where, how?
No, nothing at all, Joe. And like you just said, with the ambulance service, I would have the greatest respect for them. I think they do a great job, and it's very difficult and all of that. But it seems to me maybe that they're not very well resourced, or they haven't been properly resourced for this particular job. But I've heard nothing. No, we've registered. I've been in contact with the HSC, with the GP, with whom I registered, and so on.
So they all know. Mary McGing,
yeah.
Who have you contacted about your 90-year-old mother who hasn't got the vaccine?
Okay, so again, the GP has done everything she has to do. She has emailed the name to the National Ambulance Service on a dedicated email address.
Okay.
I phoned the National Ambulance Service the first day. They said they were working through the counties, and in our case, they couldn't say when they'd get to Mayo. The second day that I phoned, they said they were too busy to take calls. So again, I have no problem with anybody who got vaccinated. Good luck to them if they were in the list and came in rota. And we have no problem with the GP, and the National Ambulance Service are wonderful. But the HSE are putting a spin out there that everybody's been taken care of and they're not.
Okay. And Mary, how is your mother? How is she keeping?
She's good, but she's housebound, and she hasn't been out of the house since February 2020.
Oh, my God. And Adrian, how's your dad, Daniel?
Yeah, he's doing okay, Joe. He was in hospital there just after Christmas. He got out about 5 or 6 weeks ago, and it was then I registered him because I wasn't sure when he'd be at home. But heard nothing in the meantime. I mean, it's very upsetting because every time I see him or talk to him or whatever, he asks about any news about the vaccine, and I'm not able to tell him anything. You know, it's frustrating and upsetting, as I say.
Okay, two more people. 193, 190. We wish them both well and keep campaigning on it, Adrian and Mary. Okay, 51551. Watch hands.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
On Friday, we were contacted by Jane McGarry. Actually, we're trying to get in touch with Jane again in the last few minutes. Was it number 62 or number 12? There's two houses in Merrion Square. We're looking for people. I think it was number 62, Merrion Square. And she found a treasure trove of documentation and photographs belonged to a man called Martin Lyons. And she wanted to reunite them. And that was the message that went out. The other house in Merrion Square is the house where Violet Gibson lived, the woman that shot Mussolini. And we were looking for relatives of Violet, so far unsuccessfully. But we have come across and been in contact with Linda Northrup. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, Linda. You are the widow of the late Martin Lyons. Linda, good afternoon.
Hello.
And you were in Rock Island in Quebec in Canada.
Yes, that's just about where I am. I'm actually in a town, it's not even a real town, it's called Ogden.
Okay.
But very close to Rock Island. It's directly on the Vermont border with the U.S. So.
And tell us about Martin Lyons.
Well, he was a rather extraordinary person.
Mm-hmm.
I met him in Montreal in 1970, where he had landed. He had come over to Montreal with an Irish stage designer, Sean Kenny, who was working on the British pavilion at Expo 67.
Okay.
And Montreal was a very interesting place in those days. There were people from all over the world, and he soon had a very interesting group of friends. I met him, as I said, in 1970. In the early 60s, I believe he had already left Ireland. He was spending time in Spain. He studied art history in Madrid at the university, but he didn't pursue a degree, but he was definitely enrolled in courses. And then decided that that wasn't what he wanted to do, and meanwhile he had also been doing some photography. In any case, when he came to Montreal, he had worked for Expo 67.
Okay.
And then after that, he probably as a result of that, he ended up working as an audiovisual consultant at the Hemisphere in San Antonio, Texas.
Nice.
And as a result of that experience, he spent a lot of time in Mexico, mainly on ranches, and he was very interested in horsemanship and ranching.
Okay.
So the portfolio of photographs that he took then and in later years is now at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. They asked for it, and so they now have that collection. After that, what can I tell you? He never went back to Ireland. He left Ireland, and he, as one of his boyhood friends said, had a different vision. Ireland was a very different place in those days, from what I've gathered, and he left and never wanted to go back, and so he never spoke about it very much.
Okay.
And since the late 90s, and now that we have a daughter, he had begun to reconnect with his family. He has some sisters in New Jersey, and now many nieces and nephews there as well. And we had begun to get to know them and have strengthened those ties, actually, since then, but especially since his death. My daughter has become very good friends with many of her cousins and nieces and nephews, whatever, in New Jersey, but also in Ireland.
Mm.
And so it's been a wonderful reconnection.
Mm-hmm.
And I myself have now been to Ireland two or three times.
Okay.
I never went with Martin, which was always a bit sad for me that I never got to know it with him, but he simply didn't want to go. So I've only heard bits and pieces of the story, and that's why these photos and documents will be so interesting.
Yeah. And you married Martin. Yourself and Martin were married in 1982.
That's right.
Correct. Okay.
Yes.
And you met.
But I had known him since 1970.
Wow.
And we had traveled a lot during that time. I was when I met him, I was a student, a graduate student at McGill.
Yeah.
University in Montreal, and I was in Middle East history, and I ended up spending a year in Cairo, and he worked up in northern Manitoba on a dam, building a dam. Of course, he always had his camera with him.
Yeah.
He always used Leicas, but he always had his camera with him, so he ended up with a portfolio of photographs of building the dam. And those photographs, I believe, are still at the McCord. I have copies of them as well. And then he came to join me in Cairo, where we lived for about a year that time. And then we went back again in 1982 to 85. And during that time, we also spent time in Jerusalem, where he ended up photographing for the British School of Archaeology, their exhibit for the Festival of Islam. He had many, many, many adventures. He traveled to Yemen. He would be horrified with what is going on now.
Oh, my God, yes.
He met the person who became a very good friend and who invited him to Yemen on the top of the pyramid, the Great Pyramid in Cairo. We had our good friend was the inspector of antiquities, and you could not just walk up because it's a very dangerous climb. In fact, many people fall every year trying to do it. In any case, we were escorted up, and at the top there was another group of Yemenis, and Martin and I met them, and then they invited Martin to go to Yemen, which he subsequently did twice. And walked all over that country. He absolutely adored it.
What an incredible adventure.
There.
Yeah.
And those photographs are in the Notman archives at the McCord Museum in Montreal.
Wow. So his photographs are in the Smithsonian, which means they're archived properly. As you say, some of them are in McCord University as well. But Linda, what can I ask you, what age was Martin when he passed in 2002?
He was 63. It's been exactly 19 years this month died.
A young man.
He died of amniolateral sclerosis, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or Lou Gehrig's disease, or motor neuron disease. Yeah. It has various names. So it was a very, very tough time.
And did he tell you where he was born in Ireland, Linda?
Yes, he was born in Dublin or near Dublin. He always claimed to have been born in Dublin.
Okay.
But he grew up in Dunshaughlin, but his roots were in Mayo, and I believe, according to family, that he spent many summers in Mayo. His mother was from Mayo. His father was from Galway. But he grew up in Dunshaughlin, which I had the occasion to visit just two or three years ago. For the first time.
And did you know about the 82 Merrion Square connection?
No, I did not know about Merrion Square, although he had spoken, and I have a photograph, the same photograph, I believe, of the so-called Nelson Six standing next to Nelson's head.
Yes, yes.
So I did know about that, and he was very proud of that photograph.
Was he? Okay.
I do have it, yes. But he had never, at least to my memory, of course, I wouldn't have known Merrion.
When you were in Ireland, Linda, as you say, without Martin, did you go to, say, for example, to the National Gallery in Dublin? Did you visit the National Gallery?
I was actually there for a wedding last time I was there, and the first time I was there was a funeral. And I did go to the Beatty
Is that right?
Oh, the Chester Beatty, yeah. Another
yes,
wonderful.
The Chester Beatty Library.
Art gallery, yeah.
With a friend, but I only had one day and we did not go, but I will be back again.
Okay, and you went to the Chester Beatty because of your Middle Eastern interests.
Yes.
It's a fantastic, yes. A fantastic museum stroke gallery. Linda, we have Jane McGarry on the line, is the woman who contacted us. Jane.
That's very exciting, and I want to thank her for her efforts to reunite the photos and letters with the family. That's really wonderful.
You're very welcome indeed, Linda. I'm delighted that they're going to go to their rightful home. It would have been, you know, such a huge tragedy had they been just disposed of, you know.
Yeah. And
especially as Martin left his early life, it was a bit of a mystery. I mean, we knew a little bit about it, but not in great detail. Mm-hmm. And so this will certainly help to fill in the gaps. And I did know that he had spent some time in Dublin, but this may give us more information about that time and even earlier days, maybe. Yeah. We'll see.
Well, this is certainly from the mid to late 60s, and my husband recollects him very well as a neighbor, so he must have been there a while.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's very interesting. It might have been his base because I don't know exactly the timeline for when he was in Madrid, but
that'll be the bullfighting photos.
1966 was the bombing of the Nelson statue.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yeah.
And then it was 67 that he, or maybe it was, he must have gone very soon after that to Montreal because they had to prepare for Expo 67. So he would have had to be working on that a little bit in advance, I would imagine.
We've sent you more, I think we've sent you more photographs in the last few minutes, Linda. I don't know whether you can open up your email while we're talking. And Jane, did you know that Martin had passed? That Martin was dead now nearly 19 years.
No, of course not. I mean, we knew nothing of him from the time that he left Merrion Square.
Okay.
And you know, it was only conjecture from the various photographs, the path that his life had taken, and as I said, the bullfight pictures, I didn't know whether they...
Oh, you had, but you have bullfight pictures, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think the bullfight pictures were taken in Spain because he often spoke about the bullfights in Spain.
Yeah.
And there's a number of photographs, including, what did you say, Jane? One of the, on Friday, one female who looks French.
Yes.
And was she in correspondence with Martin?
Yes, she was.
Okay. He was a fine, handsome man, Linda. Tall and
I would agree.
Yeah, what an incredible, a short life, unfortunately, 63, but what an incredible life in terms of travel. But Linda, if it's not too hurtful, why did he not want to come back to Ireland?
I think he felt that life there was just too restricted. I don't know. In fact, I just know that he was not interested. I think he, as his boyhood friend told me, he had a different vision.
Okay.
And he also had family here in New Jersey, although he was out of touch with them until our wedding, in fact. And then he contacted his sister
But Linda, you said you came to Ireland twice, one for a wedding, one for a funeral. Could Martin have come on those occasions if he had decided? In other words, was he...
Could Martin
have come on those occasions? Did he say no?
Oh, yes.
So he said, no, Linda, you go to Ireland on
your
own.
No, this was after his death. This was only in the last, I would say... the funeral would have been in 2012 in February, and that was his brother who died. And then the wedding was a little bit more recently.
Okay. But you're saying he was adamant that he would not come back to Ireland.
He was until just, you know, after our daughter was born and I would say after the wedding that we attended in New Jersey, when many family and friends came from Ireland, and he met everyone again, then he began to say, I'm ready to go back. So I think, you know, had he not fallen ill, he definitely would have gone back, and he would have taken Martina with him.
Jane,
can I ask Linda, I didn't hear the earlier part of your conversation with Joe. So are there two sisters, or were there two sisters? Because they are mentioned in one of the letters.
Well, there were two sisters in New Jersey. There was Noreen, who is still with us, and there is Brige, who died about 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay.
And we knew them both, we know them both, and they're absolutely wonderful, and their families. And now my daughter is friends with many of their children.
Okay.
He had another sister in Ireland who has just recently died this last month, I think February or March.
Oh, gross.
She died. Yeah. And there was another sister, has another sister as well who has also died. So in any case, yes, he has several sisters and a couple of brothers.
Well, yourself and Jane are now in contact. With new technology, you can see most of the photographs this afternoon, and I'm sure you'll then have a chat about how to actually exchange the original documents. But Linda Northrup, God rest Martin Lyons. As I say, sounds like a remarkable man, and countries like Yemen, which today, a beautiful, beautiful country, today riven by, in a lot of cases, the work of outside forces and, unfortunately, man-made famine. Linda, thanks indeed, and condolences about Martin. Kind regards to you.
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity, and thank you, Jane, for making the effort to be in touch. And I've received the photographs, so I have them here in front of me.
Okay.
This will be fun.
A selection only of the 200.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, that's a start.
Glad to be of help. Stay well and stay safe in these times, Linda Northrup and Jane McGarry, two very, very different and distant parts of the world. I'm glad to unite them. 51551 Washington.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
It was this day last week we were talking to the family relatives of Esther McCann, Esther and Jessica McCann, who were murdered by Frank McCann, Jessica's husband. And indeed, Frank McCann's family came on, Bernard McCann, his brother, and both of them were saying, appealing to the parole board, because he's applied for parole, you can do so after 7 years, to listen to their side of the story. And because they felt McCann was imminently going to get temporary release. Now, that hasn't happened, as you know. But Michael Campbell, and the previous weeks we had other stories as well of people appealing for their assailants not to be released. Michael Campbell, Michael, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. Yeah, it's Michal. How are you?
Michal. Your daughter, Kira, was murdered by her so-called ex-boyfriend, Gordon Malloy. And you want to raise the case because you don't believe Malloy should get out of prison either.
No. Kira was murdered, and our only daughter, child, was murdered on the 12th of November, 2007.
Okay.
In a premeditated murder. If there's any little ears listening there, maybe they should go to the next room.
He
stabbed her at least 28 times in a premeditated murder. He had broken into her house. He lay in wait for our daughter coming home from a night out. Mm. And he did what he did. And then he attempted to have sex with her dead corpse. With her corpse.
So he got Malloy got a life sentence.
Malloy got a life sentence, and I'll never forget the time we were leaving the courthouse, and our liaison officer was driving. Frank Stevenson is our liaison officer, and he was driving us back from the courthouse. And I said to my wife, I said, "Well, that's that part over." And Frank turned around and looked at us, and he goes, "Life doesn't mean life, not in this country." And he says, "He can apply for parole after 7 years." And I remember us looking at each other after all we'd been through, all the hurt, the pain, and the heartache, and we couldn't believe that at the time, you know. And Malloy was sentenced in July 2009. This is still 2021, like it's only 12 years into a life sentence. And he's been up for parole twice, and we had been told he's been up for, like, we've been told to prepare for three times, like.
And the other element of it is, Micheál, that Malloy had been released early from prison when he murdered your daughter.
Yeah.
He was doing...
Yeah, I was just going to refer to your program last week when you were talking about parole and people getting out and day visits. I was on with you last year, Joe, about the day visits, and we got great support, and Malloy was actually refused his second day visit out. After the show.
But
Malloy was up for a charge in Carlow Court, the local courthouse, and he was found guilty of ABH. He attacked a person with a snooker ball or a pool ball and a sock, and was found guilty of what he did. And the local court let him out on sureties of, I think it was 2,000 or 5,000 euro. I can't be exactly sure of that. But so he was let out pending what sentence he would get. And that's when he murdered our daughter. Oh, he was actually out. That's, you know, he was out on bail, which is, and it's like, it's an equivalent of a parole, isn't it? Really, it's the same thing. You're out when you shouldn't be out. So, like, in our eyes, like, Ciara would still be alive if Malloy had been put in prison that time.
And he had threatened Ciara before, hadn't he?
He had threatened Ciara before, yeah. He had followed her. He'd sat outside her house in the car, playing music, drinking. He had followed her. But it's like, you know, Ciara had gone back to college in St. Catharines in Carlow, and she had, Jamie, our grandson, her son, had started primary school in Carlow. It's just, you know, everything was going right for her again. She'd got rid of Malloy, but he followed her everywhere she went, and he threatened her in public. And, you know, her friends stood up in court to witness what he had said to her in public, you know. And this is the lad who then, choose our system, can apply for parole three times so far. Now, last time was last May, and he was refused again, thank God. But, you know, the letter did state that, you know, that is, you know, it's nearly his right to apply again within 2 years.
And were the family asked to make a submission?
We have up to date we've made at least three submissions, at least three times, and those submissions Malloy can see.
Yeah,
he can see everything we send in, anything we have to say. He sees it, his side, as he was able to see it. But we don't, you know, we can't see anything that that's happening on the inside. On his case, you know.
And little Jamie obviously is what would he be now? 20, 19?
Oh,
20?
He's 18, Joe.
18.
He's just turned 18 last November,
He went through an awful lot as well. Still going through,
He's still going through it day by day, Joe, You know, he lives here with his mammo and his daddo when he should be living with his mommy, and... You know, but the system's like, it's the system that's wrong here, Joe. Like, you know, if there was mandatory sentencing, there would be no parole after 7 years or 12, as the new bill that's meant to be enacted says 12 still hasn't been put in. you know, this should be enforced, but now it should be signed off, and it should be, you know, it's the victims and their families.
I know the new, there's talk about a new parole board. Now there's one that will have a victim's representative. But the other element is it will be at an arm's length from the political system. So I don't know, in terms of influencing it, or I presume they will hear from families before they make decisions, but I hope they could hear the pain from the McCann family last weekend, this day last week on Live Lane. They can hear the pain today from the family of Ciara, yourself, Micheál, Ciara's father. Let's hope it makes a difference.
There should be someone on the parole board who can actually express the real pain and the real hurt. Like, you know, it is a real pain. It's a pain in your chest daily. It's real pain. It's like, you know, I remember when we were at college and you were doing poetry and you read the old Sean Filioque, and people were talking about the pain being ripped out of people's, you know, chests when of death. That's what it does feel like. There's something ripped out of you. And, you know, there should be someone on that parole board who can actually express those feelings and express how the victims and the families, you know, like, there's nothing there for us. There's no support. There should be someone on that who can actually go on to the parole board.
And Micheál, you reminded me that you were on before. Was it... Now, correct me, check me. Was it not that Malloy had got day release?
Yes, that's
Had your family been told?
We were told because we had, as you said earlier, Malloy was actually out on bail when he murdered Ciara.
Yeah.
So when he was actually he was actually put into Clover Hill, and then further on in the Portlaoise jail, he actually had to attend Carlow local courthouse again over the first charge.
Of course, yeah.
And I was actually walking up the steps of Carlow courthouse, and who was standing at the top of it? Malloy, where he was to be in jail. And I was on completely different business, Joe. Complete different business. Yeah. And I couldn't believe it. Now, imagine the person who murdered your daughter, you walk up the steps of a courthouse or anywhere else, and there he is standing there, right in front of me. So, our liaison officer in the prison service at the time set up a deal that if Malloy ever had to leave, we would know in case a scenario like that ever happened again.
Okay.
That's how we know Malloy is, you know, if he's like, we actually know he's actually getting out again in the next distant future for a hospital appointment. They actually contact us to tell us.
Okay. Well, we know that.
That's how we knew he was getting out on the day release that time, Joe.
Yeah.
And then that's why we rang you, we rang other people, and there was a massive campaign.
And that was the end of it for.
Yeah. He never got out the second time, but he got out the first time.
Yeah, I know that, and that's why you raise it publicly. Minister Helen McEntee's office were on to us last week. They said she had heard all the communication and discussions and contributions from the McCann family, both Frank McCann, the direct family, and his wife's family. And she said she will take into account the concerns of victims and survivors and will be happy to see a victim's representative on the new parole board. So let's hope your story is heard as well, Micheál. And again, condolences on 22 years of age.
Thanks, Joe. I know there will be lots of people who would be happy to go on to that parole board for the support to get a voice on it, voice for the victims and their families.
Okay. Micheál Campbell, thanks again. That's Micheál, father of Ciara, murdered by Gordon Malloy.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Back to more stories of groups of young teenagers and antisocial behaviour. Rita is in Carrigaline in Cork, I presume. Rita, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. I feel a bit of a fraud. Now, after that man,
no,
you
know,
you're fine. My troubles are very little compared to that man's troubles.
Terrible. No, you're not. You don't. And Michal will stand by you. He I think I've interviewed Michal a few times, and he wants people to stand up to him, no matter what the level of crime. What happened in your case, Rita?
Well, I've had my windows smashed three times over the last year.
Wow.
And the second time, the guard said to me, there was nothing they could do if they're under 16 unless they catch them in the act. But I find that the kids don't seem to have any fear of the guards whatsoever.
So they've attacked your home three times.
Three times.
And you reckon it's the same gang?
My windows. It's the same. No, unfortunately, I live in a gable end house.
Okay.
And there's a path next to it to other estates.
Right.
And they can pass through. They pass through there. And I seem to be, my house seems to be just an easy target, like. But they're all under 16, like.
Yeah.
And there doesn't seem to be any laws for under 16 year olds.
And the attacks we heard earlier on obviously had a racist undertone, to say the least. Rita, what are they, just out of control? And when they get together,
I think they're out of control. Boredom. I don't know what it is. Honestly, I honestly don't know what it is. It's just getting out of control altogether.
This all happened since the pandemic started. Are they in school or out of school?
No, it happened before that as well. I've had graffiti put on my wall. Just seems to be an easy target. I call the guards even during the day to them, and the guards would come up and they'd get out their phones and start filming the guards and say, you can't touch me and you can't.
The attacks we've just been describing in the last 2 weeks, they are totally brazen, and they feel totally immune to any form of authority.
But I don't know, are there any laws for under 16 year olds? Can you find that out? Is there anything, you know, can they have any sanctions against them?
Well, they're supposed to be put in touch with the juvenile liaison. But in terms of sanctions, now people often talk about sanctions on their parents.
Parents, yeah. I don't know. I'd love to.
But the main thing would be policing. Like, if you'd find at that age, if they do get a stern warning and the guard, you do know, find out who they are and keep an eye on them, that does help enormously. Enormously.
But 2 weeks ago now, there was a rock thrown through my front window.
God.
And my four-year-old granddaughter could have been sleeping in there, like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't know whether she was or not. And the guards didn't come for 20 minutes. Then they rang back on Monday morning and said, oh, there was a lot of damage done in Carrigaline on that particular night.
And what time of day or night? What time of night was it, Rita?
This was about 1 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, for God's sake.
Yeah.
So you're in your bed?
Yeah. And it's just an awful, frightening experience, like.
Okay.
It really is.
I can understand. Okay, Rita, thanks indeed. That's Rita in Carrigaline in County Cork, and more antisocial calls and vaccination calls, I could tell you, for tomorrow on Liveline. Lisa Marie Berry produced, Dave Gibson on sound, Maeve Mooney's the BCO, and Ray Darcy is next.